Washington Court of Appeals, Division 1, is now in session. Honorable James Perrella presiding.
All right, you're seated. First up is State versus Sagers. Sagers.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. Jennifer Kaplan on behalf of Appellant Andrew Sagers. I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal, please.
Two?
Yes. Bizarre, peculiar, odd, and unlikely. These are the words that the responding officers used to describe the facts that were presented to them, a 911 call that was improbable on its face. Nonetheless, these officers removed Mr. Sagers from his home, put him on the ground, handcuffed his hands behind his back, and put him in a police car.
Does Navarette change the landscape? Yesterday's U.S. Supreme Court decision?
No, Your Honor. Obviously, we liked the dissent in that case more than the majority, but I think that Navarette actually helps Mr. Sagers more than it harms him. Navarette does seem to credit the anonymous 911 phone call more than perhaps we would have liked. However, Navarette was very clear, first, that 911 calls are not per se reliable, and second, that even an eyewitness account is not necessarily sufficient to provide reasonable suspicion. And the court said, tips are dependent upon content and the degree of reliability. And even a reliable tip will justify an investigative stop only if it creates reasonable suspicion of ongoing criminal conduct. There was no reasonable suspicion in this case because the police did not even believe that the 911 call that had been made was an actual crime.
When you check down the factors, though, that Navarette went through, the majority went through, you do have... there was completely anonymous here. You did have a name and a birth date, right? You had purporting to be an eyewitness in both situations. You had innocuous details only that were being confirmed, the car's description and location of the car, close in time and proximity in both cases from the reported event. You do have a 911 call that has some indicia of reliability, no matter how you read the majority opinion. You've got the serious nature of risk to the public, DUI in one case, potential domestic violence with the gun in public on the porch in the other case, our case. And then you've got they show up and follow the car in Navarette for 5 minutes and don't see any improper driving, and that's excused by saying, well, of course people are going to drive more carefully when they know the police are following. Here they go to the house, they don't see guns out. Of course people are going to hide their guns as soon as the police arrive.
The story here is far more improbable than the story in Navarette. We have to back up a little bit before the 911 call to remember that Officer Walter, the responding officer in this case, had just 13 minutes prior to the 911 call gotten off the phone with someone who said that he was outside appellant's residence and had wanted a civil standby. He was angry, rambling, and upset, according to Officer Walter. When he got off the phone 13 minutes later, a completely improbable 911 call occurs. First, the person says that he was walking his dog at 3 in the morning, and he saw this very unlikely altercation where there was a drug transaction, though he didn't say how he knew it was a drug transaction, and that someone had hit a woman in the face and then went inside and got a shotgun, and the woman stuck around and waited after getting hit in the face so that she could be further brutalized by this person. He then said that he had witnessed the event 5 minutes prior, but he called from a payphone that was more than 10 minutes away. And he said that he had arrived there on foot. That doesn't make any sense. Further, Officer Walter arrived at the scene at appellant's house at 3:18. He saw that the appellant's suburban truck was parked in the driveway and that there was another car blocking it in. And at 3:19, he got information saying that the suburban truck was driving in the area of the 911 caller, and he saw it turn around in a restaurant parking lot.
Okay, so you're right. I mean, the way that you began your account with all those adjectives, bizarre, unbelievable, and so on and so forth. Nevertheless, I think what we have to focus on is the police conduct. So I think even in your brief somewhere, you say that you're not really being critical of the police for thinking that they needed to do something to check it out, right? I mean, you're not saying that they should have said, oh, boy, this is clearly unbelievable. Let's go back and have another cup of coffee and forget about it. So what should they have done? I mean, you said that they got Mr. What's his name? Sagers out and handcuffed him and then put him in the back of the police car and so forth. So should they not have done that, or was the problem that they asked him too many questions once they did get him into custody?
Both were problems. First, I don't think that it's sufficient to say that we should just be focusing on the conduct, because we also have to determine what their state of mind was. Because if they didn't believe at the time that a crime had actually occurred, we can't say that there's reasonable suspicion. And there's no case law that says that it's all right for police to strongly discredit the information that appears before them, but nonetheless detain an individual. However, even if we were to say that it is to do that.
Aren't we trying to figure out a rule that guides the police, or are we just trying to look at it in hindsight and say, you know, this was a travesty, which it does seem, I will have to admit, to have been. And just clearly it seems that in retrospect one can see that this was a prank. I don't even know if prank is too nice a word for it. You know, this was a vengeful, this was the very thing, so it seems, that all of the law about anonymous and unreliable tipsters is worried about, that exactly this sort of thing happens and interferes with the privacy of the individual. So, okay, all of that is there. But what should the police do? I mean, should they have not gone?
No, Your Honor, but
when they got there, should they have stopped once they saw that the house was dark, or shouldn't they have said, well, you know, it's really bizarre, but, you know, these domestic violence cases are bizarre. A lot of them are bizarre. People don't behave the way that you would think normally rational people would.
Sure. Well, first, this isn't a case of hindsight, because they had discussed the possibility that this was not a legitimate 911 call from the outset. They didn't have reasonable suspicion. But to get to your point, I think that they did the right thing by going and investigating. They went to the house. They saw that there was no conduct. There's a lot that they could have done short of detaining Mr. Sagers with his hands cuffed behind his back in a police car. They could have rang the doorbell and talked to him. When he came to the house, and he obviously didn't have any weapons with him, and he wasn't being combative, there was no reason to continue detaining him. And then not only did they detain him, but even after they had conducted a sweep of the house and determined that there was no criminal conduct that had occurred, they continued to question him, and they tried to elicit consent to search his home on that basis. And so they vastly exceeded the scope of what it wasn't even reasonable suspicion to begin with.
So as far as Mr. Sagers is concerned, the damage was done when Officer Mills, I guess it was, asked him whether he owned a shotgun, and he said yes. And this is what got him into the immediate problem here, is that he wasn't supposed to have a shotgun.
Yeah, but Officer Mills didn't know that at the time. He asked Mr. Sagers, I see my time has expired, I'll answer your question. He asked Mr. Sagers whether he had brandished a shotgun. He said no. He asked, do you own a shotgun? He said yes. At that point, he was unhandcuffed, but he wasn't told he was free to leave. At that point, after he was unhandcuffed, Officer Mills, like everyone else on the team, had determined that the crime that they had been called to investigate did not occur.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, I'm Jennifer Joseph, Deputy Prosecuting Attorney for King County, appearing on behalf of the state. And we're asking this Court to affirm Mr. Sagers' conviction for unlawful possession of a firearm, because the officers in this case did exactly what we need them to do and what we expect them to do. They responded quickly to a 911 call about a violent altercation. They proceeded with the least amount of intrusion that they could to investigate that case, and once their suspicions were dispelled, they went on their way.
That's a debatable point, isn't it?
Well, they arrived as my opposing counsel has conceded, it was proper for them to go to the house. Once they got to the house, they tried to call into the house. Had Mr. Sagers answered the phone, perhaps they could have dispelled their suspicion at that point, but he didn't answer the phone. So Mr. Seger's attorney argues that they could have...
Well, that wouldn't have dispelled their suspicions. I mean, let's not start putting the blame on Mr. Seger's here for not answering his phone. I mean,
no, indeed.
They needed to see in their minds that there was not a woman in there being beaten up.
Correct.
Well, his answering the phone, you know, setting aside the fact that apparently he was asleep, wasn't going to do it.
And knocking
but
on the...
Why did they have to get him out there and lay him down and put handcuffs on him and get him in the car and start asking him about whether he had a shotgun?
Well, the information that the officers had when they responded to the house was that somebody in that house had a shotgun and had used it to threaten somebody. The officers are not required to go up and knock on the door and put themselves in danger in order to investigate that claim. So when he comes to the door, the officers testified that they did handcuff him for officer safety, and they moved him away from the house because they weren't sure who inside might have access to that shotgun, and they didn't want to put him in danger. They put him into the police car for the same reasons, and they asked him questions that were reasonably calculated to be able to dispel this 911 report. And I think it's disingenuous to say that the officers knew that the 911 report was probably false when they got there. The officers did not testify to that. They testified that they recognized that there was a question about it, that they recognized that it was the same address that they had just had a phone call about.
They suspected it was an unreliable report.
They had some
That's
suspicions.
That's fair to say, isn't it?
I think that it's fair to say that they had questions about it, but that they felt it was their duty to investigate nonetheless. And now, I think there's no question about that.
Navarette kind of leaves some questions unanswered, doesn't it? I mean, they say this is a close call, and they go through and they don't focus, at least as my first read is, they don't focus on this is an exigent circumstances where reliability takes a back seat. It's a dangerous, it's risky, we've got to get there quickly, don't have time to verify reliability of the anonymous tip or the unknown name tip. But there's some red flags here all along the way, right? We've got this odd circumstance of 15 minutes after Mr. Tompkins calls for a civil standby at 3 in the morning, you've got this reported incident. The officers themselves are discussing the questionable nature of that call. You've got, although there's no finding, we have evidence in the record that by 3:12, 3:21, someone has gone to the payphone at the gas station. No one's there anymore. The phone's hanging off the hook. Aren't those all along the way suspicious circumstances which are undercutting the reliability that Navarette seems to be clinging to as the basis for that stop?
Well, I think that one of the ways that the officers explained that is very instructive. They said, you know, we saw that this was involving the same house, but we didn't know whether somebody who was very desperate to get into the house, which we know because they called the police at 3 o'clock in the morning for a civil standby, maybe they were dissatisfied with my services, said the officer, and they were going to take matters into their own hands. So, you know, Judge Becker asked, what are the officers supposed to do? There are consequences to not taking any action, too. If he had shot somebody with that shotgun, this would be, of course, a very different situation and a very tragic one. So they can't just not do anything. We know that. We know they have to go to the house. We know that they have to make sure that there's no woman inside. That's exactly what they did.
Of course, at the time, Officer Mills, whoever it is asking the critical questions in the patrol car. He knows himself the house has been secured. There's no woman present. There's Eddie, who's inside the house, that the other officers are speaking to at the same time. He doesn't know what that information is. But doesn't he know at that point that any exigencies have dissipated? There's no apparent person involved in a domestic violence incident at the location. There's no one walking around with a gun in the house, or guns apparently available in the house. So at that point, have they lost whatever basis they have for this exigent circumstance stop?
Well, I don't think that they have. I mean, as the trial court was very clear that these conversations between that Officer Mills was having, the conduct that he was engaged in, and the rest of the officers were happening at exactly the same time. This is a fluid situation, and Officer Mills doesn't know anything except there's not a woman in the house.
And the house is secure.
And the house is
secure. There's no apparent guns in the house. No one walked.
Well, I don't know that he knows that there's no apparent guns in the house. Nobody's walking around with a gun.
Let me say something to the extent that he was standing at the front door while the other officers were securing the house, and he would have expected them to say something if there was some imminent danger. So he surmised there was no imminent danger.
Granted, but, you know, this is a totality of the circumstances, common sense application of, and, you know, that's what the analysis is. So we don't need to, it's not appropriate to say, you know, should this officer at this very point have known that 1 minute before, you know, he had reasonable suspicion, 1 minute after, maybe he didn't.
It's a fluid situation. Navarrete says, you know, these are very fact-based determinations. That's what all of the Washington State cases say also. And so that leaves a lot of room for making these rulings, doesn't it? I mean, one of the things that's different about here in Navarrete, apparently the Supreme Court thinks there's some weight to be put on the fact that people won't use cell phones lightly to call 911. This guy used a payphone, whoever he was. And so there's really no way, you know, you can't say, well, here's a person who really wouldn't have minded being contacted again to find out who it was. To the extent that Mr. Sagers wanted to sue somebody for ratting him out to the police in the middle of the night and causing all this commotion, he wouldn't have been able to prove that it was Mr. Tompkins again.
Well, I think there's some indication in the record that the 911 call was recorded. It may have been subsequently destroyed, but at the moment, yes, the officers, one of the officers testified that he either had asked or had considered asking dispatch to listen to the recordings and see if there was a match in the voice, if they could do that. And that information in some of the other cases that talk about the sort of inherent reliability of 911 calls talk about, you know, I believe it's California Supreme Court case testified, well, you know, maybe it's not something that the police could verify themselves, but the person who was the target of the prank could listen to that phone call and see that it was, and identify the person by their voice. And, you know, this is a, you know, not great facts for saying that 911 calls are inherently reliable. But nevertheless, the fact that this did turn out to be a prank was not something that the police understood at the time that they made the contact and did their investigation. And the fact that it did end up being a prank is no more relevant to the consideration of the totality of the circumstances and the reasonableness of the stop, as it's no more relevant to that analysis than if the stop happened without any reasonable suspicion and yet the police found the shotgun. That doesn't make an illegal search legal, just like this fact that this is a prank doesn't make a legal search illegal. And I think that, you know, this court has repeatedly observed that in situations involving a report of a violent crime involving guns, the police need to be able to act quickly to respond to that. We want them to do that. That's what they did in this case. Once they got there, their actions were, I think, beyond reproach. They tried a less intrusive way to get Sagers to come out and talk to them. It didn't work. When they got to the door, they secured him for their own personal safety, and they let him go as soon as their concerns about the 911 call were dispelled.
If the stop was inappropriate to begin with, or at some point in time it no longer was appropriate, any information gained after that point, there's no back door right here that he voluntarily let them go into his house to retrieve the gun. That tainted information.
I agree. I agree with that.
So I guess he could have walked away then once the officer unhandcuffed him. Is that right?
He could have. That was
and
the officer's testimony.
In that case, if they'd decided that they wanted to investigate further, they would have had to get a warrant, I take it? They would have had to have probable cause.
I agree.
So
at that point, that they would have known for sure that he had a firearm and was not allowed to have one, so they would have had probable cause.
Well, I'm talking about before they asked him if he owned one. He was free to go, wasn't he, before that question was asked of him?
I don't believe that's the case. I believe that they elicited from him that he had a shotgun before they decided
before
that the
prank call. Him?
Yes, I believe that's the case. I would have to check the record to be certain. Thank you.
Your Honors, one of the major holdings of Navarrete is that reasonable suspicion has to justify a belief that there is ongoing criminal conduct, and that did not occur in this case. And the state has been pressing the idea that the police had to investigate the possibility that there was a woman in the house. There was no reason to believe that there was a woman in the house. The 911 caller never said that the woman had gone inside the house. To the contrary, what the 911 caller said was that she stuck around after she'd been hit in the face, which was weird, but then that she drove away. And he didn't say that he thought that she had returned for some reason, and the 911 caller left then. So there was no reason to believe that there was a woman in the house to begin with. So even if the police were to believe that some criminal conduct had occurred, there was no basis for believing that there was a ongoing situation. Rather, it had ended, and they had options that they could have used to investigate that did not involve handcuffing Mr. Sagers and putting him in the back of a police car. Finally, I want to reiterate that none of the courts have ever found that there's a firearm exception, that the fact that a caller says that a gun is involved means that police have the ability to supersede the normal reasonable suspicions requirements of either the United States or the Washington Constitution. In both JL v. Florida and in State v. Vandover, both courts said, yes, there was a gun involved. However, that doesn't mean that reasonable suspicion requirements go out the window. And for those reasons, Your Honor, we ask this court to reverse the findings of the trial court and vacate Mr. Sager's convictions. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you both. Next up is Johnson versus City.